Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the results of Tuesday's primaries in Florida and Arizona and speak with the progressive activist Howie Klein, who blogs at downwithtyranny.com and supports and advises progressive candidates, one of whom, Andrew Gillum, the African-American mayor of Tallahassee, pulled off a surprise upset win in Florida's gubernatorial race and now faces Republican Ron DeSantis, a cartoon Trumpster who right out of the gate urged Floridians in a racist dog whistle call not to monkey up the GOP's chances of winning in Florida. We will discuss the battle within the Democratic Party between the establishment and progressive insurgents like Andrew Gillum, who generated grassroots enthusiasm and support, while across most of the House and Senate races in Florida and Arizona, well-funded establishment Democrats won most of the races. We will also look into reports that Republican donors are engaged in a subversive form of political triage by funding conservative Democratic candidates in primaries. Resigned to the prospect that the Democratic blue wave will sweep Republicans out of the House, apparently some big GOP donors are secretly funding the other side of the aisle to ensure that the next Congress will not move too much in a progressive direction. Then, with Trump punishing Canada out of pure spite because he is out to destroy Prime Minister Trudeau, who he has labeled weak and dishonest, we will speak with Rodrigue Tremblay, Professor Emeritus of Economics and International Finance at the University of Montreal. He served as a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements of the North America Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, the very agreement Trump is undoing with a new U.S.-Mexico accord, which has blindsided the Canadians, who have only a few days until Friday to negotiate their way into the new deal or be left on the sidelines at the mercy of the giant American economy, 10 times the size of Canada's. Then finally, we'll examine the apparent surrender by Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer in a deal with Mitch McConnell to confirm a bunch of Trump's judges so that the senators could get out of town, a craven move which prompted Schumer's former spokesman, Brian Fallon, to fume, quote, "Trading this many lifetime positions away for a couple of days back home in the dead of August is a metaphor for how myopic the Democrats' approach has been at this dark moment in history." Andrew Kroll, the D.C. Bureau Chief for Rolling Stone, joins us to discuss White House Counsel Don McGahn's departure and Andy's article at Rolling Stone, Inside Trump's Judicial Takeover. And joining us now is Howie Klein, a progressive blogger and political activist, as well as a concert promoter, disc jockey, music producer, record label founder, record label executive, and professor of music, who was president of Reprise Records. He supports and advises progressive candidates and blogs at downwithtyranny.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Howie Klein.
Thanks, Ian.
So, Howie, I understand Andrew Gillum, who pulled off the stunning upset victory in Florida, and he could, you know, he's I don't know, you could tell us what do you think of his fortunes will be. I mean, the fellow that he's running against, to my mind, is an absolute cartoon Trumpster. But as much as there was enthusiasm on the Democratic side, there were actually more Republicans came out to vote in Florida's primary than Democrats. So that would indicate some more work to be done on the Democratic side. But Andrew Gillum's an old friend of yours, is he not? So tell us about him.
Yeah, he is an old friend of mine. I've known him for about two decades. He was the leader. I'm part of People for the American Way. I'm on their board. And Andrew was the first head of young elected officials, which would help to train young, you know, whether it's a city councilman or even a school board member, helped train them to be able to communicate progressive values and help them to rise, you know, to become mayors and members of Congress. And I think that Andrew is our first governor. I'm sure he is, in fact, the first governor from that organization, Young Elected Officials. So, like I said, I've known him for a long time. He's a great guy. And Blue America, as soon as he decided, in fact, before he decided he was going to run, I had been talking with him about it and urging him to run. And I mean, I used to try to talk him into running for Congress from his area. He was the mayor of Tallahassee most recently. Oh, he still is the mayor of Tallahassee. But I had been trying to talk him into years ago to running against Gwen Graham, who is a very, very right-wing Democrat. She was a blue dog who voted very frequently with the Republicans when she was in Congress. And I used to try talking Andrew into running against her, and he never wanted to. And here he wound up running against her for governor, and she was heavily favored. I mean, literally every poll except his own polls were showing her winning right up until the day before the election. And you know, winning fairly significantly. And, you know, I think what happened is that the polling companies just weren't polling African-American voters is really what it amounted to. And I don't think they meant not to, but I think they were not connecting with African-American voters. And that's why there was that really severe undercount. And you know, he did pretty well. I mean, he won every major city in the state. I mean, not one didn't go to him. And there were two... there were two conservatives in that race. I mean, Gwen Graham was number one, and number two was the mayor, the former mayor of Miami Beach, who is, you know, another kind of awful candidate. But you know, these are the kind of candidates that the Democrats often put up in Florida, and then they keep losing, and then the Democrats don't understand why do we keep losing to these terrible Republicans. It's because they're putting up Republican-like candidates, and they just lose election after election after election. I mean, it's awful, and they don't figure out until this time that maybe if you put a Democrat who's really a Democrat in there, or a progressive Democrat who stands for something and has put a message out to people where he's telling them, this is what I want to do. And it's not him saying, you know, I won't be as bad as the Republican. I mean, the way that the Democrats play this is always. And when I say the Democrats, I mean the establishment, you know, whether it's the DCCC or the DSCC or the DNC. They always play it like we have to have a big tent, so we have to have all kinds of people in our party, including, you know, real conservatives, many, many, many so-called ex-Republicans. So let's just be a little bit better than the Republicans. And in other words, their whole strategy is lesser of two evils. Like they never want to be as bad as the Republicans, but they don't want to be too much better because they're afraid if they're too much better, then what's going to happen is they won't be able to accommodate their vision of independence, because they've got it all wrong what independents want. And then what they do understand is rich donors. That's who they really want to accommodate. And they're afraid if they go too far in the direction of progressive values and progressive policies, they're going to lose their wealthy donors. I mean, it's amazing how the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, has tried their best, and in many cases, in most cases, I'm afraid, succeeded in rooting out people, candidates, who support Medicare for All. I mean, they just do not want candidates running on Medicare for All. And yet, in 85% of the country, 85% of Democrats are now polling as in favor of Medicare for All. So just think of that, 85%. I mean, when do you ever see a number that big for something like that that's supposedly controversial? So you've got 85% of Democrats, you've got over 70% of the whole country, and you even have a slight majority, not a plurality. You got about 52% of Republicans want Medicare for All. And yet the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee is telling Democratic candidates that's too progressive. Well, what does that mean? It's too progressive. It's too progressive for who? The 85% of the party, right, that wants it, or the 70% of Americans who want it? Who is it too progressive for? And it's only their wealthy donors. They don't want it because they don't want to pay taxes. It's that simple. And, you know, if you're going to do something like that, you can't have these Trump tax cuts. It just won't work. So
Well, Howie, let me reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Howie Klein, a progressive blogger and political activist, as well as a concert promoter, disc jockey, music producer, record label founder, record label executive, and professor of music, who was president of Reprise Records. He supports and advises progressive candidates and blogs at downwithtyranny.com. And a friend of his just got elected. Andrew Gillum, the mayor of Tallahassee, just got elected to run for the governorship in Florida, which is a big deal, obviously an important state. What's going on, though, with the FBI inquiry into the city hall in Tallahassee? Are they going to go after him, the Republicans? I mean, they already, as I mentioned, Ron DeSantis, the candidate running against him, came out with that outrageously racist dog whistle, talking about warning people not to monkey up their chances of holding on to Florida.
They will definitely go after him, and he's a pretty whistle clean kind of guy. But they are going to go after him, and as you've probably noticed over the last couple of years since Trump got in there, truth doesn't mean anything anymore. They create their own reality. I mean, when Kellyanne Conway said, it's there are alternative realities. She meant it. They literally think if they say things and they say it loud enough and often enough and they use their big lie technique, they can define reality. And that's what they're going to try to do. They do it all the time. And that's what American politics is turning into. And it's horrifying, because what is someone going to do? How do they know who to believe or not to believe? That was the whole goal of Trump and his allies, to discredit the media. Because the media has served as a kind of a gateway to truth of some kind. You can't just say something that has no basis, which is exactly what the Republicans are doing. I mean, Trump was on Twitter this morning already calling Andrew a dream candidate for DeSantis. I mean, DeSantis is he's not a normal Republican. A normal Republican was the guy he ran against, Adam Putnam. I mean, Adam Putnam was taking – he used to be a member of the House leadership in Congress quite some time ago, and he decided he wanted to run for governor. I'm talking about 10 years ago. And the way to do that is you have to get into – you go in certain ways. If you're a Republican and you want to become a governor, there are things that you do. And one of them is to be what they call the Secretary of Agriculture. The Secretary of Agriculture is more than just the Secretary of Agriculture. He or she is also the in charge of consumer affairs. So it's a fairly big job with and gives you a lot of exposure. And that will lead to a way to run for governor. And he took that route, and he planned it for 10 years, and he was certainly the front runner. There was no question he was the front runner. And I don't want to say anything good about him, but he's still a mainstream conservative. He's not an off-the-map kind of lunatic. DeSantis, on the other hand, is an off-the-map lunatic. He's crazy. If you wanted to be honest and you want to compare the two, if Putnam is a mainstream conservative, and he's definitely a conservative, I mean, he's not like a moderate or anything like that. He is a conservative. But if DeSantis isn't a conservative, I mean, conservatives want to keep things as they are. They don't want change. DeSantis, like Trump, is a radical extremist, and that was what he did in Congress. He was he's a little bit of a backbencher, but he's always on the extreme. And it's horrible to say, but if you want to be honest, you would have to say he's a neo-fascist. And he's the one that's running against Andrew. And Trump was on Twitter today saying that DeSantis has the dream candidate
to run against, right?
Yeah. So what's coming. I mean, they're going to be.
Oh, right.
Trump is going to be just shouting to the heavens about Andrew this and Andrew that. I know it. Andrew knows it, and no one doesn't expect it. So right. What's going to happen? The Democrats are going to vote for Democrats. Certainly the extremist Republicans are going to vote for him. The Trump people are going to vote for him. But what about the Adam Putnam people? Are they going to gather around Santos and vote for him now? Some of them, I'm sure they will. But I wonder, I mean, I think he, the last time I looked, I think he had 500,000 or 600,000 votes. And you have to ask yourself, are those people going to sit it out? Or how many of them are going to vote for Andrew? And how many of them are going to vote for Santos? It's going to be an interesting question. Now, on the other side, how will Andrew be able to sort of make peace with the Gwen Graham voters? She came in second, and my guess is yes, because you know they have more in common than they have not in common. Mm-hmm. Unlike the Republicans, where we're talking about a mainstream conservative versus an extremist neo-fascist. So they have a lot less in common. Sure. Does that get to their voters? Are the voters going to see it that way? Don't know.
So just in the last couple of minutes, Howie, because I wanted to have you touch on Arizona. Martha McSally, the fighter pilot Republican who's going to be running for Jeff Flake's seat against Kyrsten Sinema. She made the remark today that Kyrsten Sinema has 100 pairs of shoes and I flew 100 combat missions. So how's that going to turn out?
How's it going to turn out? All of the polling shows that Sinema will win. Okay. Some of that polling is a little bit funny because the Republicans were fighting each other. She didn't have to fight at all. She spent $10 million trying to define herself during the primary, not to fight off a Democrat, but to define herself for the general election. The problem is kind of funny because they're already attacking her as a liberal. They're just saying she's too liberal for Arizona. The fact of the matter is, I don't like her because she's way, way too conservative. She is literally the most Republican-like member of Congress among any Democrat. And I'm not just saying that as hyperbole. If you look at a Progressive Punch, which keeps a record of every vote, you'll find her at the very bottom. So there's got to be one worst, and then there's a second worst and a third worst. She's the worst. She's the head of the Blue Dog caucus. So she's number one. She runs it. She votes with the Republicans more off on crucial votes, so not on naming post offices, but on things that are important. She votes with them more than any other Democrat. I've known her well. For many, many years, long before she was in Congress. I can just tell you, she's absolutely awful and on the right. I mean, but the difference in policy between her and McSally, there are differences, and she's not as bad as McSally, of course, but it's not that big of a difference. I mean, when it's going to come to voting, there'll be a few things that they differ on, but not that many.
So let's talk down the last couple of minutes, because it's very important to talk about what I mentioned in the opening, that there are reports that big Republican donors are engaged in this political triage. They're funding conservative Democrat candidates in these primaries. They figure that the Democrats are going to take back the House. So as a hedge, they are backing conservative Democrats in the hope that the House won't become too progressive after November.
Right. Well, they have various different strategies for why they're doing it. So when Ian just mentioned rich Republicans doing this, I mean, he's not exaggerating. So one of the people who put in huge amounts of money, one of the families that put in huge amounts of money, was the Murdoch family, the people who owned Fox News. So it's really a bad situation there. And I started seeing it for the first time when Marie Newman ran against the Blue Dog in Chicago way earlier in the year, and she looked like she was going to win. And suddenly, in the last two or three weeks of the election, all this money started pouring into independent expenditures. So it wasn't Lipinski, the Blue Dog, who was spending the money, but it was these right-wing groups that were spending the money on Lipinski, a Democrat, a Blue Dog Democrat. And that's not a district where Republicans have any chance of winning at all. So they know it's going to be a Democrat. So, and Marie Newman is a progressive Democrat. Lipinski votes with the Republicans a lot. So they started spending hundreds of thousands of dollars just smearing her, saying things that were insane. I mean, that had no connection to any kind of reality. Just made up right off the top of their heads. And they put this money through an organization called No Labels. So No Labels is a really awful bunch of people, and they were sort of laundering this money from these very, very, very wealthy Republicans and conservative Democrats both, and they destroyed her in the last week of the convention. I'm sorry, the last week of the primary, and Lipinski won. Then they started doing it to others. They thought that, hey, this is a good way to do it, and they won some elections and they lost some elections. Last night they did it to Alan Grayson in Orlando, and they were successful. It was over, I think it was 1.2 million that has been reported so far, but just Murdoch alone put in $500,000 to get Alan. They didn't want someone like Alan Grayson in Congress again. They fear him. And the Democrat who he was running against is just sort of a nothing backbencher who's corrupt and just wants to be a lobbyist when he grows up. And, you know, again, you know, mm-hmm. he voted for doctors to be charged as criminals, murderers, if they perform an abortion. He's an A from the NRA. He right. voted against Dodd-Frank. You know, just go down the line, talk about anything, and this guy is just, you know, as much a Republican as he is a Democrat.
So Howie, we've run out of time. I really hope that some of the mainstream media with a lot of resources really follow up on this story of how Republican donors.
Now that the election is over?
Well, it would have been better to have done it earlier, but at least to smoke out Murdoch in his role, because he's the most damaging person in the history of modern America. I thank you for joining us, Howie.
This stuff is all on the record. None of it's, you know, made up. It's all, you look in the FEC right. contribution list and you see the money.
Sure.
It's not hidden. It's not dark money. This is the real thing.
Right.
And
well,
anyone could find it. I gave the story to the Washington Post. They said, "Oh yeah, this is a great story." They didn't do it.
Well, Howie, I thank you for joining us, and I hope somebody does pick it up. And again, I've been speaking with Howie Klein, who's a progressive blogger and political activist, as well as a concert promoter, disc jockey, music producer, record label founder, record label executive, and professor of music, who was president of Reprise Record. He supports and advises progressive candidates and blogs at Down with Tyranny. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Trump is punishing Canada out of pure spite because he's out to destroy Prime Minister Trudeau.
Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Roderick Tremblay, who's a professor emeritus of economics and international finance at the University of Montreal. He served as president of the Canadian Economic Society, was a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements of the North America Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, and his books in English include The New American Empire, and his latest book is The Code for Global Ethics, 10 Humanist Principles. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roderick Tremblay.
Yeah, how are you, Ian?
I'm well, thanks, Roderick. And the idea that Canada, the United States' closest ally, longest ally, with the safest border in the world, is basically being bullied by a country with an economy 10 times the size. And to my mind, it's all personal. It's all about Donald Trump, who's a very spiteful man. And he for some reason or other, he thinks that Prime Minister Trudeau somehow did something that upset him. And he's just literally out to destroy Trudeau. And it looks like Canada is going to be collateral damage.
Yeah, this is very surprising because after the election, the November 2016 election. There was a meeting in early 2017 in Washington between Mr. Trump and Mr. Trudeau, and they were all friendly, and Mr. Trump said regarding trade between Canada and the United States, since we are two similar countries, there would be just only tweaking little changes, not basic changes, because most of the problems that the U.S. has on the trade-wise is with Mexico and China, with two countries with which the United States has a large current account deficit. But with Canada, the U.S. has a slight surplus, a current account surplus. So this is difficult to understand that this is going so bad suddenly, except maybe, as you say, for personal reasons. But we should be adults. If you are a leader of leaders of countries, you don't let your emotions and personal anger to take over your policies.
Well, today President Trump praised the incoming new president of Mexico, López Obrador, who's a socialist, by the way, which somehow he won over Trump. And they have, Mexicans and the Americans, the Trump administration, have been negotiating a new U.S.-Mexico accord. They don't want to call it NAFTA. Trump certainly doesn't want to call it NAFTA. But this has blindsided the Canadians, who only have a few days until Friday. So that's what Trump's doing. It's like take it or leave it.
Well, this is another thing which is hard to understand. It took 5 weeks for the Trump administration and the Mexican government and Mexico is an underdeveloped country compared to Canada, which is industrialized, and they arrive at an agreement after 5 weeks of negotiations, and they only cover 10 of the 30 chapters of the overall NAFTA agreement. So to ask Canadian negotiators and American negotiators to arrive at a final agreement only in a few days after they have not been negotiating since last May is very unrealistic. At a minimum, it would take a few weeks.
Well, it's obviously Trump's tactics, the art of the deal. He's just punishing Canada and bullying Trudeau, and he's going to probably create a recession in Canada, is he not?
Well, in Canada, Canada is a big country. You know, it's part of the G7 countries, and it's very industrialized. And if both sides are on good faith, they should come with compromises and arrive at a solution. We are talking about $600 billion of trade each year between Canada and the United States. Many American companies are doing business in Canada, and many states in the U.S., 30 states, have their main exports to Canada. That would be a very irresponsible to break these tremendous economic cooperation that exists between the country for the last 80 years. Mind you, you know, there is a long history of economic cooperation between Canada and the U.S. During the World War II, there was a North American market for military equipment. Then in 64, that's 54 years ago, there was an agreement for the auto sector with the three main American auto manufacturers, and that was signed by President L.B. Johnson and Prime Minister L.B. Pearson. And then 1988, 24 years later, then there was a comprehensive trade agreement between Canada and the U.S., a bit like they have in Europe, you know. And that was signed by President Ronald Reagan, a very Republican conservative president, and Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. And in 1994, the U.S. government insisted that Mexico be included because of the problems that the U.S. has with Mexico. And this was signed by President Bill Clinton and Prime Minister Jean Chrétien. So myself, I was a bit wary of bringing somewhat an underdeveloped country in an agreement between two developed countries. And that this is showing to be the end result now that Canada is being pushed aside and the U.S. is going with the country with which it has the most urgent problems, like
and all because because we have a leader who is unbridled, who doesn't care about political and geopolitical norms and diplomatic traditions. He just operates out of his own personal spite, and that seems to be the only explanation. I mean, I don't know how Trudeau can pull together a deal, or Chrystia Freeland, in 2 days. Trudeau himself said today that no deal is better than a bad deal. Do you think he can pull it off in 2 days?
It's impossible, I think, in 2 days. There are so many things, as I mentioned, the agreement between the Trump administration and Mexico is only covers only 10 of the 30 chapters of the trade, the overall trade agreement, which has been authorized by the U.S. Congress. There is no authorization by the U.S. Congress to make a bilateral trade between the U.S. and Mexico. It has to be done with the three countries, or they have to start from scratch, and then you have 90 days of to give Congress a notice, and then you have another 90 days by Congress to do that. So you ended up at the middle of 2019. So if it is done only for the November election, midterm election, that's not realistic either. So I hope the cooler heads will dominate and will prevent imperable damage to our both economies. It's too important. Too many wages, too many prices for consumers, too many profits for companies are involved to play like that on a whimsical whimsical way. It's too important. It would be too irresponsible.
But surely, Rodrigue Tremblay, the average Canadian must see what is obvious, that Canada is being bullied by this bully in the White House.
Well, if it is only on words, people can live with that, although it is a bit, you feel a bit betrayed, if you collaborate with a country for 80 years and participate to wars with the United States where Canadian soldiers are dying, and we had Canadian soldiers in Iraq,
Afghanistan.
And Afghanistan.
Not Iraq.
So it's very, it's sort of a betrayal of Canadians and Canada as a neighbor country. I think Canada and the U.S. live on the same continent. They should be good neighbors. They are both in NORAD. Canada and the U.S. are in the NORAD agreement to protect the North American continent. They are both in NATO. They should cooperate, not fight like two dogs, and not play dangerous and bring men-ships games. Because too much is at stake. That's the prosperity of North America.
Well, but it all comes down to that this president we have, everything he ran on, no matter how stupid it was, and no matter how ridiculous his electoral positions were, he really does feel obligated to his base to deliver on all of these crazy promises, like building a wall with Mexico. And one of his promises was to tear up NAFTA. So why doesn't Trudeau basically just call NAFTA something else?
Yeah, that's easy to do,
Just
call it North American
Love Fest. Yeah, the North American Orange Coiffure Society.
A cooperation agreement.
Yeah, whatever. Just call it anything. Would that work, do you think?
Well, the problem is that we are not dealing only with economics. Economics is scientific.
Exactly.
We're talking about politics and motivation, personal motivation and all that.
And an insecure megalomaniac who's deeply spiteful. I'm afraid we've run out of time, Rodrigue, but thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much, and I appreciate your welcome.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Rodrigue Tremblay, a professor emeritus of economics and international finance at the University of Montreal. He served as a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements on the North American Free Trade Agreement, and his books in English include The New American Empire and his newly released book, The Global Code for Ethics, 10 Human Principles. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're looking into Don McGahn's exit after stacking the courts. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Andy Kroll, the D.C. Bureau Chief for Rolling Stone and a contributing writer for the California Sunday Magazine. He has an article at Rolling Stone, Inside Trump's Judicial Takeover. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andy Kroll.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you, Andy. And there's a great deal of anger from progressive Democratic circles at the deal that Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has made with Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to essentially, for the senators to get out of town. They've allowed a whole bunch of Trump's judicial nominees for the federal bench to go through. And this has prompted Brian Fallon, who was previously Chuck Schumer's chief spokesperson. He's now the executive director of Demand Justice. And he said today, trading this many lifetime positions away for a couple of days back home in the dead of August is a metaphor for how myopic the Democrats' approach has been at this dark moment in history. What's your sense there in Washington? Is this basically being seen as a kind of surrender on the part of the Senate Democrats?
If not a surrender, then at least a major miscalculation. Hearing that criticism from Brian Fallon, who, as you rightly point out, is a former spokesperson for Senator Schumer, someone I dealt with and, frankly, maybe clashed with a few times in his capacity working for Schumer, hearing Brian Fallon make those comments is pretty striking and is indicative of a lot of the confusion and, frankly, anger that Democrats would see a few more days campaigning back in their home states, or just back in their home states, period, as worthwhile in exchange for 7 federal district court confirmations yesterday. And it sounds like possibly 7 or 8 more next week as well, according to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's office. So it's hard to see how this is a win for Democrats, and in some ways it might seem like an own goal.
Well, Trump is winning in general, is he not? He has put more people on the federal bench than any president, I think, in memory in terms of the short tenure that he's had so far.
Yeah, it's been an unbelievable, if undercovered, success for the Trump administration. they have put, as of yesterday, 60 judges onto the federal bench. Now, that includes the district court level, which is the trial level, the appeals court level, and then the Supreme Court at the top with Justice Neil Gorsuch. President Trump has put more judges onto the 13 appeals courts around the country at this point in his presidency than any president before him since the appeals courts were created in 1891. This has been, you know, I mean, it's just been an unqualified success, and the Trump administration has just been methodical about this. And, you know, it's something that we're going to live with far past the end date of the Trump administration, because like you said, these judges all have lifetime appointments. They're going to be with us for as long as they want to be on the bench.
Well, when you use the word unqualified, using it in a different context, so many of these appointees were considered unqualified by the American Bar Association. And this character, Talley, was a total embarrassment. I think his wife worked for Don McCain, the White House counsel, who Trump just announced today will be leaving the White House. I want to talk to you about that, obviously. But that was pretty outrageous, wasn't it? I mean, the kind of in-your-face sort of disregard for experience and judicial independence, I suppose that's too much to ask. I mean, we saw the antics of this Reagan appointee in the federal court there in Virginia with the Manafort trial. And it looks like he, compared to these Trumpsters that they're putting on the bench, he's a sage, is he not?
Yeah, and I was in the courtroom for the Manafort trial, so I got all of the Judge T.S. Ellis III experience that I could possibly ever want and imagine. Yeah, the best way to think about these Trump-appointed judges is that they have all passed a litmus test. That test is, do you adhere, do you believe in the doctrine of originalism? Originalism is this radical notion that the Constitution should only be interpreted according to the way that it was believed to be written when it was written hundreds of years ago. So you've got to put your mind, you got to put yourself in the mind of the framers, the folks who drafted the Constitution in that period and what those words meant in that period to properly interpret the Constitution. It's not a living document by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, it is sort of, it is a product purely of the time it was created. And all of these Trump judges have passed that test. They are originalists. They were clerks to, say, Justice Clarence Thomas. They were believers and supporters of the late Justice Antonin Scalia. This is the way they see the world. And what you've seen happen is the administration has appointed judges who may be originalists, but they also may not be qualified, or they may have, you know, highly ideological or extreme views on, say, pick an issue, campaign finance, reproductive rights, the Fourth Amendment, right to privacy,
voting rights,
exactly. Right. So that is why you've seen Brent Talley, James Ho, who is now an appeals court judge, down in Texas, and some others. And you think to yourself, these folks have extreme views, or they have complicated backgrounds, or in a few cases, the American Bar Association has said they're just grossly unqualified for the job. Why are they getting picked for the bench by the Trump White House? And it's because they subscribe to this view of originalism. That is what the Trump administration and what White House Counsel Don McGahn want in a judge. And that is why you've seen some of these characters make their way through the process. Some get confirmed to the bench, like James Ho. Some get defeated, like Brent Talley, for his judgeship in Alabama.
And again, I'm speaking with Andy Kroll, who's the D.C. Bureau Chief for Rolling Stone and a contributing writer for the California Sunday Magazine. He has an article at Rolling Stone, Inside Trump's Judicial Takeover. So Trump seemed to have wanted to take credit, if you will, for the departure of his White House counsel, Don McGahn. And it did seem that the Trump administration, and particularly the White House, was blindsided when they learned that McGahn had testified for so long, over 30 hours, to the Mueller investigation. So how do you see it? Is he trying to sort of assert himself, I'm the boss, you know, and I'm firing him, as opposed to I got completely blindsided? Because he's now, Trump is saying, I gave him permission, you know. I'm sure he didn't give him permission to spill the beans, but what do you think?
I think that McGahn is leaving of his own volition, but that the decision, as it was reported today, was put in a lot of cases in the context of, oh, McGahn has gotten a lot of unwanted attention lately. He, as you mentioned, gave more than 30 hours across three different interviews of, I wouldn't call it testimony, but, you know, he sat and gave information with Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team. He has clashed with the president over Attorney General Jeff Sessions and the Russia investigation. There's just been some tensions there, and that, you know, it was time for McGahn to just sort of make his exit. But in my opinion, you can see McGahn's departure in a different light. Namely, he is leaving the White House, mission accomplished, that he came in aiming to fill this unprecedented number of judicial openings, you know, judgeships available around the country, fill those with these originalist judges, stock the courts for a generation, including as many as two Supreme Court openings, and then go back to private practice, you know, sail into the sunset, whatever he intends to do. So this notion that maybe Don McGahn is leaving the White House with his tail between his legs, I don't think is right. I think, if anything, he will be leaving the White House having accomplished exactly what he, in tandem with Mitch McConnell in the Senate, set out to do, and that was reshape the American judiciary for decades to come. And they have succeeded in doing that.
But is that to say that McGahn is mission accomplished in terms of stacking the federal bench with, I think you could safely say, reactionaries rather than conservatives, but at the same time willing to tell the truth about Trump?
I think that's right. McGahn's an interesting character. He's not a pedigreed, you know, white shoe lawyer. At least he, you know, he wasn't for much of his career. You know, he went to a second or third tier law school. He, you know, is a New Jersey guy. His family were active in Atlantic City politics. You know, the machine of Atlantic City politics, which is how, actually, the McGahns first came into contact with Trump through the casino business there. McGahn, but he's been around Washington for a while. He's a canny operator. He's an ideologue, you know, whose goal is to, as he's put it, dismantle the administrative state, to take apart the federal government and the overreach that he sees. That means, you know, deregulation and cutting these agencies down to size. So I do think that he can see his role as both putting all of these judges, again, 60 of them and counting, could be 80 by the end of the year, putting these judges on the bench, but at the same time not getting sucked into the scandal vortex that is the Trump presidency. And that seems to be what he has done in his conversations with Mueller. You know, he went in there and ostensibly told the truth and told his side of the story. He had the counsel's office sort of recused from a lot of the personal controversies roiling President Trump. And then he's going to leave this fall, presumably after he helps push through Judge Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation to the Supreme Court. So if you're Don McGahn, you have to feel pretty good about how you came out in all of this. But the story of the Supreme Court and the story of all the other appeals and district courts that he has helped reshape is a whole other matter.
Well, we know that McGahn has clashed with Trump on the many times that Trump has wanted to fire Jeff Sessions and shut down the Mueller probe. And it looks as though Trump is probably going to do it. He may even do it before the elections. The theory is that, as put forth by Senator Lindsey Graham, is that after the midterms, they're going to get a new attorney general. But maybe if the Democrats take the House in and even the Senate, which is less likely. Trump may want to preempt that by getting rid of him earlier. So without McGahn, I mean, well, first, let me ask you this. That seems to be the track that Trump is on. He's determined to get rid of Sessions and shut down Mueller. And I think if that happens, the real question would be, will the supine Republicans who have just rolled over everything outrageous that Trump has done, will they stay silent? My guess is that they might.
My guess, based on my own reporting and reading of these kinds of hypotheticals, is that some Republicans will speak up, but I would fully expect to be underwhelmed by the response from the Republican Party to President Trump trying to do the things that you've just described. I mean, that puts us into full-blown constitutional crisis mode, right? You know, getting rid of your attorney general for not recusing himself, or firing Mueller, or firing Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who oversees the Mueller probe because Sessions recused himself. We'd be getting into Saturday Night Massacre territory, if not worse, if President Trump were to do that. You probably don't want to be the White House counsel in that moment, unless you are the true believer in what President Trump is doing. And I think you might be hard to find a good lawyer who would be a true believer in that. So it makes sense to me why maybe Don McGahn would want to get Kavanaugh confirmed and then bow out, not having to potentially grapple with, again, a constitutional crisis on the level we saw in the Nixon presidency, if President Trump were to finally act on all of these threats that he has made, whether about Rosenstein or Mueller or even Attorney General Sessions.
But Trump in no way has disguised the obvious mob boss attitude to the law. He's been saying endlessly that Sessions should never have accused himself, that he wants an attorney general that will protect him from the law as opposed to uphold the law. It's amazing. I'm astounded that any lawyer would be comfortable with a president who has that attitude. And he doesn't seem to think there's anything wrong with the idea that he should have somebody like Roy Cohn in his corner, not the attorney general, who's the chief law enforcement officer of the United States.
Every indication, every tweet, statement, any reported private comment that seems to reveal President Trump's mindset when it comes to his attorney general, his Justice Department, leads us to think he thinks that those individuals or those agencies exist to protect him. They exist to be loyal to him, as we know he's obsessed with the notion of loyalty, not to stand for some larger set of laws or principles or guidelines or ethics, period. He thinks that they work for him and they should protect him, and that's why he's been so angry at Jeff Sessions for going on 18 months now. It's why he is angry at the Justice Department and for allowing the Mueller probe to proceed as it has. I think you have to go back and look at the fact that Roy Cohn was a friend and a mentor. I think that tells you a lot about where President Trump's thinking on the law comes from and on justice comes from. And now he's the commander-in-chief of the most powerful country in the world and thinks that these agencies should do his bidding.
Well, what is just in the last couple of minutes, let me ask you, Andy Kroll, about, you mentioned that McGahn's mission accomplished finally will be, or the cherry on top of the cake, if you will be the confirmation of Judge Brett Kavanaugh. I'm hearing rumors that they may have some incriminating emails, that maybe this highly moralistic man who was kind of a scold when he worked for the special counsel, Ken Starr, the emails where he wants to expose the prurient details of Bill Clinton's sexual activities with Monica Lewinsky to the whole world are pretty upsetting. But my understanding is that Kavanaugh himself may have some skeletons in his own closets in terms of imbibing too much, shall we say, and also being a womanizer. So anything like that has come up on your radar? That's a rumor I've been hearing lately.
Having to do with, I mean, I haven't heard those rumors having to do with McGahn.
No, no, not McGahn.
Kavanaugh.
Kavanaugh himself, that he may not be as pure as a driven snow for a guy that was so moralistic about Bill Clinton's sexual proclivities.
Sure, sure. I haven't heard those rumors. I think that I wouldn't be surprised if the, you know, choir boy image that has been depicted or built up around Brett Kavanaugh is not exactly what it lives up to, or, you know, doesn't live up to its billing. But at the same time, you got to look at the math here. I mean, it's in the narrowest of margins for Republicans, though with Vice President Mike Pence able to cast a deciding vote if need be. They have the numbers, unless they have some defections, to confirm Kavanaugh. There's no filibuster anymore. I don't think any details about his background are going to break that Republican caucus that Mitch McConnell, you know, manages to hold together, unless, you know, there is something, you know, completely beyond the pale, or something revealing Brett Kavanaugh to be, say, more liberal than we ever thought him to be. But I highly doubt that. And so, you know, I think that there's a pretty good chance that Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed later this fall, just given the math, the legislative math in Congress, in the Senate right now.
And the fact that the Republicans will just stand by Trump and his nominee no matter what. That, I think, is a pretty sad comment, that whatever it is that these rumors are, it would have to be incredibly outrageous for the Republicans to reject him. I mean, that's what you're saying, right?
Yeah. I think that Mitch McConnell has a pretty good knack for keeping his caucus in line, and especially on something as consequential as a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court. He's going to have his members whipped into shape, and it's hard to see any of them. John McCain might have been one of the only ones to defy McConnell, but obviously that's not going to happen now. So I would be really surprised to see any of those Republican senators break with the rest of the party when it comes to Kavanaugh.
And Mitch McConnell, obviously, is a hero to the party because he was the guy that stopped Merrick Garland, denied Obama his choice for the Supreme Court. And the reason why Trump is filling so many judicial vacancies is that Mitch McConnell made sure there were enormous amounts of judicial vacancies because
That's right.
He filibustered everybody that Obama put forth. So there you
That's
have
right.
it.
That's right.
Well, thank you, Andy. I don't mean to rant here, but I find this whole thing rather disturbing. But I thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I always appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Andy Kroll, who's the D.C. Bureau Chief for Rolling Stone and a contributing writer for the California Sunday Magazine. And he has an article at Rolling Stone, Inside Trump's Judicial Takeover. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.